Oliver Twist, Chapters 7 through 9.
Chapter 7. Oliver Continues Refractory. Noah Claypole ran along the streets at his swiftest pace, and paused not once for breath until he reached the workhouse gate. Having rested there for a minute or so to collect a good burst of sobs and an imposing show of tears and terror, he knocked loudly at the wicket and presented such a rueful face to the aged pauper who opened it that even he, who saw nothing but rueful faces about him at the best of times, started back in astonishment. "Why, what's the matter with the boy?" said the old pauper. "Mr. Bumble! Mr. Bumble!" cried Noah, with well-affected dismay, and in tones so loud and agitated that they not only caught the ear of Mr. Bumble himself, who happened to be hard by, but alarmed him so much that he rushed into the yard without his cocked hat, which is a very curious and remarkable circumstance, as showing that even a beetle, acted upon a sudden and powerful impulse, may be afflicted with a momentary visitation of loss of self-possession and forgetfulness of personal dignity. "Oh, Mr. Bumble, sir," said Noah. "Oliver, sir! Oliver has—" "What?" interposed Mr. Bumble, with a gleam of pleasure in his metallic eyes. "Not run away. He hasn't run away, has he, Noah?" "No, sir, no. Not run away, sir. But he's turned vicious," replied Noah. "He tried to murder me, sir, and then he tried to murder Charlotte, and then Mrs. Oh, what dreadful pain it is! Such agony, please, sir!" And here Noah writhed and twisted his body into an extensive variety of eel-like positions, thereby giving Mr. Bumble to understand that, from the violent and sanguinary onset of Oliver Twist, he had sustained severe internal injury and damage, from which he was at that moment suffering the acutest torture. When Noah saw that the intelligence he communicated perfectly paralyzed Mr. Bumble, he imparted an additional effect thereunto by bewailing his dreadful wounds 10 times louder than before. And when he observed a gentleman in a white waistcoat crossing the yard, he was more tragic in his lamentations than ever, rightly conceiving it highly expedient to attract the notice and rouse the indignation of the gentleman aforesaid. The gentleman's notice was very soon attracted, for he had not walked 3 paces when he turned angrily round and inquired what that young cur was howling for, and why Mr. Bumble did not favor him with something which would render the series of vocular explanations so designated an involuntary process. "It's a poor boy from the free school, sir," replied Mr. Bumble, "who has been nearly murdered, all but murdered, sir, by young Twist." "By Jove!" exclaimed the gentleman in the white waistcoat, stopping short. "I knew it! I felt a strange presentiment from the very first that that audacious young savage would come to be hung." "He has likewise attempted, sir, to murder the female servant," said Mr. Bumble, with a face of ashy paleness. "And his missus," interposed Mr. Claypole. "And his master, too, I think you said," added Mr. Bumble. "No, he's out, or he would have murdered him," replied Noah. "He said he wanted to." "Ah, said he wanted to, did he, my boy?" inquired the gentleman in the white waistcoat. "Yes, sir," replied Noah. "And please, sir, missus wants to know whether Mr. Bumble can spare time to step up there directly and flog him, 'cause master's out." "Certainly, my boy, certainly," said the gentleman in the white waistcoat, smiling benignly and patting Noah's head, which was about 3 inches higher than his own. "You're a good boy, a very good boy. Here's a penny for you. Bumble, just step up to Sourberry's with your cane and see what's best to be done. Don't spare him, Bumble." "No, I will not, sir," replied the beadle. And the cocked hat and the cane having been, by this time, adjusted to their owner's satisfaction, Mr. Bumble and Noah Claypole betook themselves with all speed to the undertaker's shop. Here the position of affairs had not at all improved. Sourberry had not yet returned, and Oliver continued to kick, with undiminished vigor, at the cellar door. The accounts of his ferocity, as related by Mrs. Sourberry and Charlotte, were of so startling a nature that Mr. Bumble judged it prudent to parley before opening the door. With this view, he gave a kick at the outside by way of prelude, and then, applying his mouth to the keyhole, said in a deep and impressive tone, "Oliver!" "Come, you let me out," replied Oliver from the inside. "Do you know this here voice, Oliver?" said Mr. Bumble. "Yes," replied Oliver. "Ain't you afraid of it, sir? Ain't you a-trembling while I speak, sir?" said Mr. Bumble. "No," replied Oliver, boldly. An answer so different from the one that he had expected to elicit, and was in the habit of receiving, staggered Mr. Bumble not a little. He stepped back from the keyhole, drew up himself to his full height, and looked from one to another of the 3 bystanders in mute astonishment. "Oh, you know, Mr. Bumble, he must be mad," said Mrs. Sourberry. "No boy in half his senses could venture to speak so to you." "It's not madness, ma'am," replied Mr. Bumble, after a few moments of deep meditation. "It's meat." "What?" exclaimed Mrs. Sowerberry. "Meat, ma'am, meat," replied Bumble, with stern emphasis. "You've overfed him, ma'am. You've raised an artificial soul and spirit in him, ma'am, unbecoming a person of his condition. As the board, Mrs. Sowerberry, who are practical philosophers, will tell you, what have paupers to do with soul or spirit? It's quite enough that we let him have live bodies. If you had kept the boy on gruel, ma'am, this never would have happened." "Dear, dear," ejaculated Mrs. Sowerberry, piously raising her eyes to the kitchen ceiling, "this comes of being liberal." The liberality of Mrs. Sowerberry to Oliver had consisted of a profuse bestowal upon him of all the dirty odds and ends which nobody else would eat. So there was a great deal of meekness and self-devotion in her voluntarily remaining under Mr. Bumble's heavy accusation, of which, to do her justice, she was wholly innocent in thought, word, or deed. "Ah," said Mr. Bumble, when the lady brought her eyes down to earth again, "the only thing that can be done now, that I know of, is to leave him in the cellar for a day or so, till he's a little starved down, and then to take him out and keep him on gruel all through the apprenticeship. He comes of a bad family. Excitable natures, Mrs. Sowerberry. Both the nurse and doctor said that that mother of his made her way here against difficulties and pain that would have killed any well-disposed woman weeks before." At this point in Mr. Bumble's discourse, Oliver, just hearing enough to know that some allusion was being made to his mother, recommenced kicking with a violence that rendered every other sound inaudible. Sowerberry returned at this juncture, Oliver's offense having been explained to him with such exaggerations as the lady's thought best calculated to rouse his ire. He unlocked the cellar door in a twinkling and dragged his rebellious apprentice out by the collar. Oliver's clothes had been torn in the beating he received. His face was bruised and scratched, and his hair scattered over his forehead. The angry flush had not disappeared, however, and when he was pulled out of his prison, he scowled boldly on Noah and looked quite undismayed. "Now, you are a nice young fellow, ain't you?" said Sowerberry, giving Oliver a shake and a box on the ear. "He called my mother names," replied Oliver. "Well, and what if he did, you ungrateful little wretch?" said Mrs. Sowerberry. "She deserved what he said, and worse." "She didn't," said Oliver. "She did," said Mrs. Sowerberry. "It's a lie," said Oliver. Mrs. Sowerberry burst into a flood of tears. This flood of tears left Mr. Sowerberry no alternative. If he had hesitated with one instant to punish Oliver most severely, it must be quite clear to every experienced reader that he would have been, according to all precedents in disputes of matrimony established, a brute, an unnatural husband, an insulting creature, a base imitation of a man, and various other agreeable characters too numerous for recital within the limits of this chapter. To do him justice, he was, as far as his power went, it was not very extensive, kindly disposed towards the boy, perhaps because it was in his interest to be so, perhaps because his wife disliked him. The flood of tears, however, left him no resource, so he at once gave him a drubbing, which satisfied even Mrs. Sowerberry herself, and rendered Mr. Bumble's subsequent application of the parochial cane rather unnecessary. For the rest of the day, he was shut up in the back kitchen, in company with a pump and a slice of bread, and at night, Mrs. Sowerberry, after making various remarks outside the door, by no means complimentary to the memory of his mother, looked into the room, and amidst the jeers and pointings of Noah and Charlotte, ordered him upstairs to his dismal bed. It was not until he was left alone in the silence and stillness of the gloomy workshop of the undertaker that Oliver gave way to the feelings which the day's treatment may be supposed likely to have wakened in a mere child. He listened to their taunts with a look of contempt. He had borne the lash without a cry, for he felt that pride swelling in his heart which would have kept down a shriek to the last, though they had roasted him alive. But now, when there were none to hear or see him, he fell upon his knees on the floor, and hiding his face in his hands, wept such tears as, God send for the credit of our nature, few so young may have ever cause to pour out before him. For a long time, Oliver remained motionless in this attitude. The candle was burning low in the socket when he rose to his feet. Having gazed cautiously around him and listened intently, he gently undid the fastenings of the door and looked abroad. It was a cold, dark night. The stars seemed, to the boy's eyes, farther from the earth than he had ever seen them before. There was no wind, and the somber shadows thrown by the trees upon the ground looked sepulchral and deathlike from being so still. He softly reclosed the door, having availed himself of the expiring light of the candle to tie up in a handkerchief the few articles of wearing apparel he had, set himself down on a bench to wait for morning. With the first ray of light that struggled through the crevices in the shutters, Oliver rose and again unbarred the door. One timid look around, one moment's pause of hesitation, he had closed it behind him and was in the open street. He looked to the right and to the left, uncertain whether to fly. He remembered to have seen the wagons as they went out, toiling up the hill. He took the same route, and arriving at a footpath across the fields, which he knew, after some distance, led out again into the road, struck into it, and walked quickly on. Along the same footpath, Oliver well remembered he had trotted beside Mr. Bumble when he first carried him to the workhouse from the farm. His way lay directly in front of the cottage. His heart beat quickly when he bethought himself of this, and he half resolved to turn back. He had come a long way, though, and should lose a great deal of time by doing so. Besides, it was so early that there was very little fear of his being seen, so he walked on. He reached the house. There was no appearance of his inmates stirring at that early hour. Oliver stopped and peeped into the garden. A child was weeding one of the little beds. As he stopped, he raised his pale face and disclosed the features of one of his former companions. Oliver felt glad to see him before he went, for, though younger than himself, he had been his little friend and playmate. They had been beaten and starved and shut up together many and many a time. "Hush, Dick," said Oliver, as the boy ran to the gate and thrust his thin arm between the rails to greet him. "Is anyone up?" "Nobody but me," replied the child. "You mustn't say you saw me, Dick," said Oliver. "I am running away. They beat and ill-used me, Dick, and I am going to seek my fortune, some long way off. I don't know where. How pale you are!" "I heard the doctor tell them I was dying," replied the child with a faint smile. "I am very glad to see you, dear, but don't stop. Don't stop." "Yes, yes, I will, to say goodbye to you," replied Oliver. "I shall see you again, Dick. I know I shall. You will be well and happy." "I hope so," replied the child. "After I am dead, but not before. I know the doctor must be right, Oliver, because I dream so much of heaven and angels and kind faces that I never see when I am awake." "Kiss me," said the child, climbing up the low gate and flinging his little arms round Oliver's neck. "Goodbye, dear. God bless you." The blessing was from a young child's lips, but it was the first that Oliver had ever heard invoked upon his head, and through the struggles and sufferings and troubles and changes of his afterlife, he never once forgot it.
Chapter 8. Oliver walks to London. He encounters on the road a strange sort of young gentleman. Oliver reached the stile at which the bypath terminated, and once more gained the high road. It was 8 o'clock now. Though he was nearly 5 miles away from the town, he ran and hid behind the hedges, by turns till noon, fearing that he might be pursued and overtaken. Then he sat down to rest by the side of the milestone and began to think, for the first time, where he had better go and try to live. The stone by which he was seated bore, in large characters, an intimation that was just 70 miles from that spot to London. The name awakened a new train of ideas in the boy's mind. London! That great place! Nobody, not even Mr. Bumble, could ever find him there. He'd often heard the old men in the workhouse, too, say that no lad of spirit need want in London, and that there were ways of living in that vast city which those who'd been bred up in country parts had no idea of. It was the very place for a homeless boy who must die in the streets unless someone helped him. All these things passed through his thoughts. He jumped upon his feet and again walked forward. He had diminished the distance between himself and London by full 4 miles more before he recollected how much he must undergo ere he could hope to reach his place of destination. As this consideration forced itself upon him, he slackened his pace a little and meditated upon his means of getting there. He had a crust of bread, a coarse shirt, and 2 pairs of stockings in his bundle. He had a penny, too, a gift of sourberries after some funeral in which he had acquitted himself more than ordinarily well, in his pocket. A clean shirt, thought Oliver, is a very comfortable thing, and so are 2 pairs of darn stockings, and so is a penny. But they are small helps to a 65 miles walk in winter time. But Oliver's thoughts, like those of most other people, although they were extremely ready and active to point out his difficulties, were wholly at a loss to suggest any feasible mode of surmounting them. So, after a good deal of thinking to no particular purpose, he changed his little bundle over to the other shoulder and trudged on. Oliver walked 20 miles that day, and all that time tasted nothing but the crust of dry bread and a few draughts of water, which he begged at the cottage doors by the roadside. When the night came, he turned into a meadow and, creeping close under a hayrick, determined to lie there till morning. He felt frightened at first, for the wind moaned dismally over the empty fields, and he was cold and hungry and more alone than he ever felt before. Being very tired with his walk, however, he soon fell asleep and forgot his troubles. He felt cold and stiff when he got up next morning, and so hungry that he was obliged to exchange the penny for a small loaf in the very first village through which he passed. He had walked no more than 12 miles when night closed in again. His feet were sore, and his legs so weak that they trembled beneath him. Another night passed in the bleak, damp air made him worse. When he set forward on his journey next morning, he could hardly crawl along. He waited at the bottom of a steep hill till a stagecoach came up, and then begged of the outside passengers. But there were very few who took any notice of him, and even those told him to wait till they got to the top of the hill, and then let him see how far he could run for a halfpenny. Poor Oliver tried to keep up with the coach a little way, but was unable to do it, by reason of his fatigue and sore feet. When the outside saw this, they put their halfpence back into their pockets again, declaring that he was an idle young dog and didn't deserve anything, and the coach rattled away and left only a cloud of dust behind. In some villages, large painted boards were fixed up, warning all persons who begged within the district that they would be sent to jail. This frightened Oliver very much and made him glad to get out of those villages with all possible expedition. In others, he would stand about the inn yards and look mournfully at everyone who passed, a proceeding which generally terminated in the landlady's ordering one of the post boys who were lounging about to drive that strange boy out of the place, for she was sure he had come to steal something. If he begged at a farmer's house, 10 to 1, but they threatened to set the dog on him. And when he showed his nose in a shop, they talked about the beetle, which brought Oliver's heart into his mouth, very often the only thing he had there for many hours together. In fact, if it had not been for a very good-hearted turnpike man and a benevolent old lady, Oliver's troubles would have been shortened by the very same process which had put an end to his mother's. In other words, he would most assuredly have fallen dead upon the king's highway. But the turnpike man gave him a meal of bread and cheese, and the old lady, who had a shipwrecked grandson wandering barefoot in some distant part of the earth, took pity upon the poor orphan and gave him what little she could afford, and more, with such kind and gentle words, and such tears of sympathy and compassion, that they sank deeper into Oliver's soul than all the sufferings he had ever undergone. Early on the 7th morning after he left his native place, Oliver limped slowly into the little town of Barnett. The window shutters were closed, the street was empty, not a soul had awakened to the business of the day. The sun was rising in all its splendid beauty, but the light only served to show the boy his own lonesomeness and desolation, as he sat with bleeding feet and covered with dust upon a doorstep. By degrees the shutters were opened, the window blinds were drawn up, and the people began passing to and fro. Some few stopped to gaze at Oliver for a moment or two, or turned round to stare at him as they hurried by, but none relieved him or troubled themselves to inquire how he came there. He had no heart to beg, and there he sat. He had been crouching on the step for some time, wondering at the great number of public houses. Every other house in Barnett was a tavern, large or small, gazing listlessly at the coaches as they passed through and thinking how strange it seemed that they could do with ease in a few hours what it had taken him a whole week of courage and determination beyond his years to accomplish. When he was roused by observing that a boy who had passed him carelessly some minutes before had returned and was now surveying him most earnestly from the opposite side of the way. He took little heed of this at first, but the boy remained in the same attitude of close observation so long that Oliver raised his head and returned his steady look. Upon this, the boy crossed over and, walking close up to Oliver, said, "Hello, my covey. What's the row?" The boy, who addressed this inquiry to the young wayfarer, was about his own age, but one of the queerest-looking boys that Oliver had ever seen. He was a snub-nosed, flat-browed, common-faced boy enough, and as dirty a juvenile as one would wish to see. But he had about him all the airs and manners of a man. He was short of age, with rather bow legs and little sharp, ugly eyes, and his hat was stuck on the top of his head so lightly that it threatened to fall off every moment, and would have done so very often, if the wearer had not had a knack of every now and then giving his head a sudden twitch, which brought it back to its old place again. He wore a man's coat which reached nearly to his heels. He had turned his cuffs back halfway up his arms to get the hands out of the sleeves, apparently with the ultimate view of thrusting them into the pockets of his corduroy trousers, for there he kept them. He was altogether as roistering and swaggering a young gentleman as ever stood 4'6" or something less in the bluchers. "Hello, my covey, what's the row?" said the strange young gentleman to Oliver. "I'm very hungry and tired," replied Oliver, the tears standing in his eyes as he spoke. "I have walked a long way. I've been walking these 7 days." "Walking for 7 days?" said the young gentleman. "Oh, I see. Beak's orders, eh? But," he added, noticing Oliver's look of surprise, "I suppose you don't know what a beak is, my flash companion." Oliver mildly replied that he had always heard a bird's mouth described by the term in question. "My eyes, how green!" exclaimed the young gentleman. "Why, a beak's a magistrate, and when you walk by a beak's order, it's not straightforward, but always a going up, and never a coming down again. Was you never on the mill?" "What mill?" inquired Oliver. "What mill? Why, the mill. The mill, as it takes up so little room that it'll work inside a stone jug, and always goes better when the wind's low with people than when it's high. Cross they can't get workmen." "But come," said the young gentleman, "you want grub and you shall have it. I'm at a low water mark myself, only one bob and a magpie. But as far as it goes, I'll fork out and stump. Up with you on your pins. There, now then, Maurice." Assisting Oliver to rise, the young gentleman took him to an adjacent chandler's shop, where he purchased a sufficiency of readily dressed ham and a half-quartern loaf, or, as he himself expressed it, a fourpenny bran. The ham being kept clean and preserved from dust by the ingenious expedite of making a hole in the loaf by pulling out a portion of the crumb and stuffing it therein. Taking the bread under his arm, the young gentleman turned it into a small public house and led the way to a tap room in the rear of the premises. Here, a pot of beer was brought in by direction of the mysterious youth, and Oliver, falling to at his new friend's bidding, made a long and hearty meal, during the progress of which the strange boy eyed him from time to time with great attention. "Going to London?" said the strange boy, when Oliver had at length concluded. "Yes." "Got any lodgings?" "No." "Money?" "No." The strange boy whistled and put his arms into his pockets as far as the big coat sleeves would let them go. "Do you live in London?" inquired Oliver. "Yes, I do, when I'm at home," replied the boy. "I suppose you want some place to sleep in tonight, don't you?" "I do, indeed," answered Oliver. "I've not slept under a roof since I left the country." "Don't fret your eyelids on that score," said the young gentleman. I've got to be in London tonight, and I know a respectable old gentleman as lives there will give you lodgings for nothing and never ask for the change. That is, if any gentleman he knows introduces you. And don't he know me? Oh, no, not in the least. By no means. Certainly not. The young gentleman smiled as if to intimate that the latter fragments of discourse were playfully ironical, and finished the beer as he did so. The unexpected offer of shelter was too tempting to be resisted, especially as if it was immediately followed up by the assurance that the old gentleman referred to would doubtless provide Oliver with a comfortable place without loss of time. This led to a more friendly and confidential dialogue, from which Oliver discovered that his friend's name was Jack Dawkins, and that he was a peculiar pet and protege of the elderly gentleman before mentioned. Mr. Dawkins' appearance did not say a vast deal in favor of the comforts which his patron's interest obtained for those whom he took under his protection, but as he had a rather flighty and dissolute mode of conversing, and furthermore avowed that among his intimate friends he was better known by the sobriquet of the Artful Dodger. Oliver concluded that, being of a dissipated and careless turn, the moral precepts of his benefactor had hitherto been thrown away upon him. Under this impression, he secretly resolved to cultivate the good opinion of the old gentleman as quickly as possible, and, if he found the Dodger incorrigible, as he more than half suspected he should, to decline the honor of his farther acquaintance. As John Dawkins objected to their entering London before nightfall, it was nearly 11 o'clock when they reached the turnpike at Islington. They crossed from the Angel into St. John's Road, struck down the small street which terminates at Sadler Wells Theatre, through Exmouth Street and Coppice Row, down the little court by the side of the workhouse, across the classic ground which once bore the names of Hockley in the Hole, thence into the little Saffron Hill, and so into Saffron Hill the Great, along which the Dodger scudded at a rapid pace, directing Oliver to follow close at his heels. Although Oliver had enough to occupy his attention in keeping sight of his leader, he could not help bestowing a few hasty glances on either side of the way as he passed along. A dirtier or more wretched place he had never seen. The street was very narrow and muddy, and the air was impregnated with filthy odors. There were a good many small shops, but the only stock in trade appeared to be heaps of children who, even at that time of night, were crawling in and out of the doors or screaming from the inside. The sole places that seemed to prosper amid the general blight of the day were the public houses, and in them the lowest orders of Irish were wrangling with might and main. Covered ways and yards, which here and there diverged from the main street, disclosed little knots of houses where drunken men and women were positively wallowing in filth, and from several of the doorways great ill-looking fellows were cautiously emerging, bound to all appearances on no very well-disposed or harmless errands. Oliver was just considering whether he hadn't better run away when they reached the bottom of the hill. His conductor, catching him by the arm, pushed open the door of a house near Field Lane, and drawing him into the passage, closed it behind them. "Now then!" cried a voice from below in reply to a whistle from the Dodger. "Plummy and slam!" was the reply. This seemed to be some watchword or signal that was all right, for the light of a feeble candle gleamed on the wall at the remote end of the passage, and a man's face peeped out from where a balustrade of the old kitchen staircase had been broken away. "There's two on you," said the man, thrusting the candle farther out and shielding his eyes with his hand. "Who's the other one?" "A new pal," replied Jack Dawkins, pulling Oliver forward. "Where did he come from?" "Greenland. Is Fagin upstairs?" "Yes, he's assorting the wipes. Up with you." The candle was drawn back, and the face disappeared. Oliver, groping his way with one hand and having the other firmly grasped by his companion, ascended with much difficulty the dark and broken stairs, which his conductor mounted with an ease and expedition that showed he was well acquainted with them. He threw open the door of a back room and drew Oliver in after him. The walls and the ceiling of the room were perfectly black with age and dirt. There was a deal table before the fire, upon which were a candle stuck in a ginger beer bottle, two or three pewter pots, a loaf and butter, and a plate. In a frying pan, which was on the fire and which was secured to the mantel shelf by a string, some sausages were cooking, and standing over them with a toasting fork in his hand was a very old shriveled Jew, whose villainous-looking and repulsive face was obscured by a quantity of matted red hair. He was dressed in a greasy flannel gown with his throat bare, and seemed to be dividing his attention between the frying pan and the clothes horse, over which a great number of silk handkerchiefs were hanging. Several rough beds made of old sacks were huddled side by side on the floor. Seated round the table were four or five boys, none older than the Dodger, smoking long clay pipes and drinking spirits with the air of middle-aged men. These all crowded about their associate as he whispered a few words to the Jew, and then turned round and grinned at Oliver. So did the Jew himself, toasting fork in hand. "This is him, Fagin," said Jack Dawkins. "My friend, Oliver Twist." The Jew grinned, and making a low obeisance to Oliver, took him by the hand and hoped he should have the honor of his intimate acquaintance. Upon this, the young gentleman with the pipes came round him and shook both his hands very hard, especially the one in which he held his little bundle. One young gentleman was very anxious to hang up his cap for him, and another was so obliging as to put his hands in his pockets, in order that, as he was very tired, he might not have the trouble of emptying them himself when he went to bed. These civilities would probably be extended much farther, but for a liberal exercise of the Jew's toasting fork on the heads and shoulders of the affectionate youths who offered them. "We are very glad to see you, Oliver, very," said the Jew. "Dodger, take off the sausages and draw a tub near the fire for Oliver." "Ah, you're staring at the pocket handkerchiefs, eh, my dear? There are a good many of them, ain't there? We've just looked them out, ready for the wash. That's all, Oliver, that's all. Ha, ha, ha." The latter part of this speech was hailed by a boisterous shout from all the hopeful pupils of the merry old gentleman, in the midst of which they went to supper. Oliver ate his share, and the Jew then mixed him a glass of hot gin and water, telling him he must drink it off directly, because another gentleman wanted the tumbler. Oliver did as he was desired. Immediately afterwards he felt himself gently lifted onto one of the sacks, and then he sunk into a deep sleep.
Chapter 9, containing further particulars concerning the pleasant old gentleman and his hopeful pupils. It was late next morning when Oliver awoke from a sound, long sleep. There was no other person in the room but the old Jew, who was boiling some coffee in a saucepan for breakfast, and whistling softly to himself as he stirred it round and round with an iron spoon. He would stop every now and then to listen when there was the least noise below, and when he had satisfied himself, he would go on whistling and stirring again as before. Although Oliver had roused himself from sleep, he was not thoroughly awake. There is a drowsy state between sleeping and waking, when you dream more in 5 minutes with your eyes half open and yourself half conscious of everything that is passing around you, than you would in 5 nights with your eyes fast closed and your senses wrapped in perfect unconsciousness. At such times, a mortal knows just enough of what his mind is doing to form some glimmering conception of its mighty powers, its bounding from earth and spurning time and space, when freed from the restraint of its corporeal associate. Oliver was precisely in this condition. He saw the Jew with his half-closed eyes, heard his low whistling, and recognized the sound of the spoon grating against the saucepan sides. And yet the self-same senses were mentally engaged at the same time, in busy action with almost everybody he had ever known. When the coffee was done, the Jew drew the saucepan to the hob, standing then in a resolute attitude for a few minutes, as if he did not well know how to employ himself, he turned round and looked at Oliver and called him by his name. He did not answer, and was to all appearance asleep. After satisfying himself upon this head, the Jew stepped gently to the door, which he fastened. He then drew forth, as it seemed to Oliver, from some trap in the floor, a small box, which he placed carefully on the table. His eyes glistened as he raised the lid and looked in. Dragging an old chair to the table, he sat down and took from it a magnificent gold watch, sparkling with jewels. "Ah," said the Jew, shrugging up his shoulders and distorting every feature with a hideous grin. Clever dogs, staunch to the last. Never told the old parson where they were, never preached upon old Fagin. And why should they? It wouldn't have loosened the knot or kept the drop up a minute longer. No, fine fellas. With these and other muttered reflections of the like nature, the Jew once more deposited the watch in its place of safety. At least half a dozen more were severally drawn forth from the same box, and surveyed with equal pleasure, besides rings, brooches, bracelets, and other articles of jewelry of such magnificent materials and costly workmanship that Oliver had no idea even of their names. Having replaced these trinkets, the Jew took out another, so small that it lay in the palm of his hand. There seemed to be some very minute inscription on it, for the Jew laid it flat upon the table, and, shading it with his hand, pored over it long and earnestly. At length he put it down, as if despairing of success, and leaning back in his chair, muttered, "What a fine thing capital punishment is! Dead men never repent. Dead men never bring awkward stories to light. Ah, it's a fine thing for the trade. 5 of them strung up in a row, and none left to play booty, or turn white-livered." As the Jew uttered these words, his bright dark eyes, which had been staring vacantly before him, fell on Oliver's face. The boy's eyes were fixed on his in mute curiosity, and although the recognition was only for an instant, for the briefest space of time that can possibly be conceived, it was enough to show the old man that he had been observed. He closed the lid of the box with a loud crash, and laying his hand on a bread knife which was on the table, started furiously up. He trembled very much, though, for even in his terror, Oliver could see that the knife quivered in the air. "What's that?" said the Jew. "What do you watch me for? Why are you awake? What have you seen? Speak out, boy. Quick, for your life." "I wasn't able to sleep any longer, sir," replied Oliver meekly. "I'm very sorry if I have disturbed you, sir." "You were not awake an hour ago," said the Jew, scowling fiercely on the boy. No, indeed," replied Oliver. "Are you sure?" cried the Jew, with a still fiercer look than before and a threatening attitude. "Upon my word, I was not, sir," replied Oliver earnestly. "I was not indeed, sir." Tush, my dear," said the Jew, abruptly resuming his old manner and playing with the knife a little before he laid it down, as if to induce the belief that he had caught it up in mere sport. "Of course I know that, my dear. I only tried to frighten you. You're a brave boy. Ha, ha, you're a brave boy, Oliver." The Jew rubbed his hands with a chuckle, but glanced uneasily at the box, notwithstanding. "Did you see any of these pretty things, my dear?" said the Jew, laying his hand upon it after a short pause. "Yes, sir," replied Oliver. "Ah," said the Jew, turning rather pale. They're mine, Oliver, a little property. All I have to live upon in my old age. The folks call me a miser, my dear, only a miser, that's all." Oliver thought the old gentleman must be a decided miser to live in such a dirty place with so many watches, but thinking that perhaps his fondness for the Dodger and the other boys cost him a good deal of money, he only cast a deferential look at the Jew and asked if he might get up. "Certainly, my dear, certainly," replied the old gentleman. "Stay, there's a pitcher of water in the corner by the door. Bring it here, and I'll give you a basin to wash in, my dear." Oliver got up, walked across the room, and stooped for an instant to raise the pitcher. When he turned his head, the fox was gone. He had scarcely washed himself and made everything tidy by emptying the basement out the window, agreeably to the Jew's directions, when the Dodger returned, accompanied by a very sprightly young friend, whom Oliver had seen smoking on the previous night, and who was now formally introduced to him as Charlie Bates. The four sat down to breakfast on the coffee and some hot rolls and ham, which the Dodger had brought home in the crown of his hat. "Well," said the Jew, glancing slyly at Oliver and addressing himself to the Dodger, "I hope you've been at work this morning, my dears." "Hard," replied the Dodger. "As nails," added Charlie Bates. "Good boys, good boys," said the Jew. "What have you got, Dodger?" "A couple of pocketbooks," replied the young gentleman. "Lined?" inquired the Jew with eagerness. "Pretty well," replied the Dodger, producing two pocketbooks, one green and the other red. "Not so heavy as they might be," said the Jew, after looking at the insides carefully, "but very neat and nicely made. Ingenious workman, ain't he, Oliver?" "Very indeed, sir," said Oliver, at which Mr. Charles Bates laughed uproariously, very much to the amazement of Oliver, who saw nothing to laugh at in anything that had passed. "And what have you got, my dear?" said Fagin to Charlie Bates. "Wipes," replied Master Bates, at the same time producing four pocket handkerchiefs. "Well," said the Jew, inspecting them closely, "they're very good ones, very. You haven't marked them well, though, Charlie, so the mark shall be picked out with a needle, and we'll teach Oliver how to do it. Shall us, Oliver, eh? Ha, ha, ha." "If you please, sir," said Oliver. "You'd like to be able to make pocket handkerchiefs as easy as Charlie Bates, wouldn't you, my dear?" said the Jew. "Very much indeed, if you'll teach me, sir," replied Oliver. Master Bates saw something so exquisitely ludicrous in this reply that he burst into another laugh, which laugh, meeting the coffee he was drinking and carrying it down some wrong channel, very nearly terminated in his premature suffocation. "He is so jolly green," said Charlie when he recovered, as an apology to the company for his unpolite behavior. The Dodger said nothing, but he smoothed Oliver's hair over his eyes and said he'd know better by and by, upon which the old gentleman, observing Oliver's color mounting, changed the subject by asking whether there had been much of a crowd at the execution that morning. This made him wonder more and more, for it was plain from the replies of the two boys that they had both been there, and Oliver naturally wondered how they could possibly have found time to be so very industrious. When the breakfast was cleared away, the merry old gentleman and the two boys played a very curious and uncommon game, which was performed in this way. The merry old gentleman, placing a snuff-box in one pocket of his trousers, a note-case in the other, and a watch in his waistcoat pocket with a guard chain round his neck, and sticking a mock diamond pin in his shirt, buttoned his coat tight round him, and putting his spectacle case and handkerchief in his pockets, trotted up and down the room with a stick, in imitation of the manner in which old gentlemen walk about the streets any hour in the day. Sometimes he stopped at the fireplace, and sometimes at the door, making believe that he was staring with all his might into shop windows. At such times he would look constantly round him, for fear of thieves, and would keep slapping all his pockets in turn to see that he hadn't lost anything in such a very funny and natural manner that Oliver laughed till the tears ran down his face. All this time the two boys followed him closely about, getting out of his sight so nimbly every time he turned round that it was impossible to follow their motions. At last the Dodger trod upon his toes or ran upon his boot accidentally, while Charlie Bates stumbled up against him behind, and in that one moment they took from him, with the most extraordinary rapidity, snuff-box, note-case, watch-guard, chain, shirt-pin, pocket-handkerchief, even the spectacle-case. If the old gentleman felt a hand in any one of his pockets, he cried out where it was, and then the game began all over again. When this game had been played a great many times, a couple of young ladies called to see the young gentleman, one of whom was named Bet, and the other Nancy. They wore a good deal of hair, not very neatly turned up behind, and were rather untidy about the shoes and stockings. They were not exactly pretty either, but they had a great deal of color in their faces and looked quite stout and hearty, being remarkably free and agreeable in their manners. Oliver thought them very nice girls indeed, as there is no doubt they were. These visitors stopped a long time. Spirits were produced in consequence of one of the young ladies complaining of a coldness in her inside, and the conversation took a very convivial and improving turn. At length, Charlie Bates expressed his opinion that it was time to pad the hoof. This, it occurred to Oliver, must be French for going out, for directly afterwards the Dodger and Charlie and the two young ladies went away together, having been kindly furnished by the amiable old Jew with money to spend. "There, my dear," said Fagin, "that's a pleasant life, isn't it? They have gone out for the day." "Have they done work, sir?" inquired Oliver. "Yes," said the Jew. "That is, unless they should unexpectedly come across any when they are out, and they won't neglect it if they do, my dear, depend upon it. Make 'em your models, my dear. Make 'em your models," tapping the fire shovel on the hearth to add force to his words. "Do everything they bid you, and take their advice in all matters, especially the Dodgers, my dear. He'll be a great man himself, and will make you one, too, if you take pattern by him." "Is my handkerchief hanging out of my pocket, my dear?" said the Jew, stopping short. "Yes, sir," said Oliver. "See if you can take it out without my feeling it, as you saw them do when we were at play this morning." Oliver held up the bottom of the pocket with one hand, as he had seen the Dodger hold it, and drew the handkerchief lightly out of it with the other. "Is it gone?" cried the Jew. "Here it is, sir," said Oliver, showing it in his hand. "You're a clever boy, my dear," said the playful old gentleman, patting Oliver on the head approvingly. "I never saw a sharper lad. Here's a shilling for you. If you go on in this way, you'll be the greatest man of the time. And now come here, and I'll show you how to take the marks out of the handkerchiefs." Oliver wondered what picking the old gentleman's pocket in play had to do with his chances of being a great man. But thinking that the Jew, being so much his senior, must know best, he followed him quietly to the table and was soon deeply involved in his new study.